Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN Radio. I get to talk to the very best people. I'm very lucky about that. I'm very privileged about that. We happen to be here at the Western Veterinary Conference in Las Vegas. This is Dr. Chris Pockel, a veterinary behaviorist. I don't think I could be at a veterinary conference without seeing you. I don't think there could be a veterinary conference without you speaking at a conference. You're everywhere, man.
I try. I try, and I do enjoy it. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to share information with pet parents and veterinarians and bridging those gaps.
You know what I really hate as a speaker, though? I see my name, and then you're speaking at the same time. I'm lucky to get anyone in the room to watch me.
I've seen your room, Steve. I think you're not selling yourself quite enough there. But
and one of the topics that you talk about, one of the topics I talk about as well, is separation anxiety. We come from it from a slightly different direction, but I want to talk about what that is and frankly what that isn't, because I think often it's misidentified. Here's my line. I don't believe that many pet parents, and we're talking dogs for the moment, so though cats can definitely have separation anxiety. But let's stick to dogs just for this conversation. I don't think that many people would come home from the office and say, oh, I think my dog's diabetic, or I think my dog has heart disease. I don't think that separation anxiety is any different, in that I believe what I'm getting at is a veterinarian actually needs to decide whether that's going on. What do you think?
I do think that analogy is really a smart one, Steve. And I think the thing that we really have to think about in those scenarios is, you know, separation anxiety is a very specific set of criteria. And while there can be a lot of separation-related problems, not all of them are separation anxiety, where we're seeing that true emotional response, that negative emotional state associated with some key clinical signs. And so really having somebody who understands how to differentiate those patterns to make sure that we're not only labeling it correctly, but that we're also moving down the pathway of appropriate interventions.
So what I tell people, the first thing, I didn't tell them this 5 years ago even, because it was more expensive, but now it's $25 or $30 to get a camera. And most people have a smartphone, and whatever's on that camera you can see or show your veterinarian on your smartphone. And your veterinarian will know whether your dog is barking at the door, because your dog is just barking at the door. Or whether your dog is, if you live in an apartment, barking at the door because bing, bing, the elevator down the hall went. Or now you don't know it, but there's a party in the hallway when you're not home half the time, and your dog is doing what dogs do and is responding to people, or barking at the window because the postal carrier, is that the right terminology?
Mail carrier or the postal, sure, the delivery person.
Thank you. And there are more and more of those anyway. Yes. Is coming to the house and woof, woof, person goes away. And I did my job. That's what that's about.
Yeah.
Or the dog is tearing up the pillows just because you have a dog that doesn't know how to be home alone, or is just having a good time doing it because your dog never learned not to do it.
Yes.
None of those are separation anxiety.
Correct. And what you're describing there too, Steve, is the relationship between the behavior, in this case, whether we're talking vocalizations or destructive behavior, and the antecedents or the conditions that would predict, you know, what are the provocative triggers? What are the things that are doing that? And if we come home to, let's say, a neighbor's complaint about barking, or the pillow was destroyed in the living room, we're seeing evidence, but it's not enough to be able to draw that conclusion. So I agree with you. You know, going back 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, video was tough and it was inconvenient. It's really accessible right now. And even if I have a client who has, let's say, two devices, they've got an iPad, they've got a phone, I'll have them set up a Zoom call between their two devices, take one of them with them out to the driveway, and they can use equipment they already have. They don't have to spend a dime. You know, So there's so many options to be able to get us the data, the true diagnostic information that we need, not that we want, that we absolutely need in order to confirm that diagnosis.
So before I ask you, and I will, what you do to help dogs with separation distress or separation anxiety, I want to talk to you about what not to do. So there was a television commercial during the Super Bowl, I think it was 2 years ago. You know which commercial I'm talking about?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
I actually play this commercial in my talks, by the way. And the commercial was for Amazon. And it shows this poor dog who clearly, when people go back to work after the pandemic, is anxious, more than a bit anxious, and is even doing things when people are home, which is one thing dogs with separation anxiety don't do. They don't take pictures off the wall, typically, which is something this dog did. But also, at the end of the commercial, it's very sweet. There's a big package that comes. Inside it is a crate. Inside that crate's another dog.
I'm sighing over on the other side here. I know.
So part of my question is, how often really should you deliver a dog in a crate? That doesn't seem like a good idea.
Whole other topic there. Right?
But aside from that, is getting another dog for a dog with separation anxiety the solution to all your problems?
Yeah, it's generally not the solution. If anything, for some dogs, it can help as a management strategy so your dog is not truly isolated. But what that fails to really take into account, well, there's a lot of things that fails to take into account. One of them is, for a lot of dogs, the source of the distress is being separated from their people. It's not just whether they're alone. Now, there are certain types of separation anxiety that we might refer to as isolation distress, where having any other warm body in that environment could be helpful. But even still, it's a management strategy. It avoids some of that panic response, but it's not giving that dog any better coping skills for navigating that true source of discomfort. And that's ultimately where I find the success in treatment comes from, is actually onboarding the skills, changing the emotional response, improving that animal's outlook on that particular situation. And that's really hard to do with a dog that gets delivered in a crate, right? That's just not going to fix it.
What's more, what I tell people is, now you might have two dogs with separation anxiety. Now, that new puppy doesn't maybe necessarily have true separation anxiety, but has learned, this is what I do when people leave the house. I bark, or I rip up the pillows, or I'm not house trained anyway, but now there's not even a chance that that's going to happen because this other dog is urinating in the house.
Yeah, and there's a lot of social learning that can happen. And whether they're learning quote unquote bad behavior or unwanted behavior or problematic behavior, or whether they're actually picking up on some of those distress cues, all of those things can happen. So generally speaking, if I have a client who says, oh, I want to get a second dog, and I have a dog with separation anxiety, I try to tease those out so we're not using one of those as the solution for the other. We may still be able to get a second dog in that household, but again, not as the solution.
All right. So what are the solutions? When we come back, we'll talk about what some of them are. Well, I want to also talk about what seems to be common sense, but we have a problem. We're human beings. So sometimes our response to what we see when we come home, and some people won't even leave the house because they have a dog with separation distress, so they get so distressed. We'll talk about all that when we come back on WGN. Veterinary behaviorist Dr. Chris Pockel is here to talk about, I don't know if it is, but I think it might be, the most common behavior problem in dogs today.
Certainly right up there. Yeah, talking about separation anxiety.
Yeah. Do you think there's more of it today?
That's a great question.
And today includes post-pandemic as part of my question.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of variables that go into that. I think we're not only seeing it because of some of the life circumstances that have affected us all over these last years, and I think we're also better at recognizing it. And so how much of that changes the actual numbers, hard to say, but it's really a common issue.
Would you help me bust a myth? So some people say that if I adopt a dog from an animal shelter, the chances of separation anxiety, oh, I'm in trouble. I'm probably going to get a dog with that.
Yeah, I wouldn't automatically assume that, right? That's not anything that I would go into it knowing that is going to be the case, right? I think in any case, when we are adopting an animal with an unknown history, it may take time to get to know them, to know what their likes and dislikes and preferences or aversions happen to be, but I wouldn't make that association directly.
Right. I don't think that research has shown that, although some dogs may have been given up to the shelter because they had separation anxiety. It does seem from the study that I saw that dogs that have been relinquished several times, they more likely are predisposed.
Yeah, and that certainly may be the case. And again, every dog is an individual, right? So we never know, even if we look at a study and if we said 22% or 67%, I don't know which dogs are in that 67 or 22% until we actually look at the observable behaviors and we see how this particular dog does.
I'm sure you've seen video like I'm about to describe. The people come home and they see that there was some destruction in the house, or maybe the dog had accidents. And people like you and me say, don't punish the dog. And they're not. But yet they see what they see, and the dog immediately picks up on it. And then they leap to the fact that the dog is guilty. Talk about that.
Yeah, the guilty look. It's a tough one because, you know, if you're the pet parent in that scenario, you see, as you described, the situation. You see a change in the dog's body language or their emotional state, and it's really easy to link those two things together. And dogs are absolutely intelligent creatures. There's no doubt about that. What they're not as good at is moving forward and backwards in time. And that's sort of something that guilty response requires, right? To have a dog who's going, oh gosh, you're home now and I peed 20 minutes ago or 4 hours ago. I shouldn't have done that. I feel terrible. Oh my gosh, what am I going to do? We just don't see that as the response. And there have been studies that have sort of disambiguated that guilty look as well. And ultimately what happens is that dogs are masters at picking up on social cues. And so even if we just come home and go,
just like that?
No, that may be all it takes, right?
Yeah,
and you have
an
exasperated, frustrated, angry even owner. Even if they're not directly punishing that animal, you may have an animal who goes, gosh, when my people come home, that's kind of a stressful moment. And so I'm going to show some of these body language cues that are intended to diffuse threatening or uncomfortable situations. So we see that whole host of appeasement behaviors. The tail is down, the ears are down, they're crouching or slinking around. And again, they quote unquote look guilty. But those animals aren't going back in time to think, oh, next time I'll do better.
Yeah.
Right? They just don't have the ability in most circumstances to do that.
And I do need to bring this up. What about people that say, I am going to punish my dog in some way because my dog did bad here?
Yeah.
What does that do?
So in most cases, number one, it doesn't help, right? The ability for the animal to connect that correction, punishment, reprimand to the act of doing the thing they did at some point in the past, their ability to connect those things is pretty limited in most circumstances. So it's not going to help. And the worry is that if we're adding something that's an unpleasant experience to that animal's learning history, especially if that's being done in a way that the animal doesn't fully understand or can't connect to behavior, well, now an unpleasant thing is happening unpredictably, and that's actually a recipe for situational or generalized anxiety.
And they call it separation anxiety because it's anxiety.
It is.
Now adding to the anxiety.
Yeah, we certainly can. And every animal is going to be a little bit different in terms of their predisposition to anxiety. But again, not helpful, runs the risk of making things worse, and we can do better.
Okay, so here we go. How do we do better? How do we help these dogs?
Yeah, I think there's a combination of things that we can do. One of them is, as best we can, avoid leaving them alone. Not because that fixes the problem. It absolutely does not fix the problem. But every time we leave them alone in a way that they're uncomfortable with, we're further kind of perpetuating that idea in their mind that being alone is a really terrible experience. So we temporarily suspend leaving them alone while we're setting them up to have a positive experience, whether that's using a food releasing toy, whether it's training relaxation, whether it's even just starting out with really baby departures to just help them acclimate to those circumstances. There's a variety of different training exercises we can do that change the emotional response, the association, the behavior that they're actually performing in that moment to truly develop a skill set of being comfortable when they're alone.
But what if you can't do that because of your lifestyle, your schedule, you have to work or whatever it is, you have to keep leaving the dog alone. But do you?
Yeah, that's a really common scenario for a lot of my clients and pet parents as well. They said, well, I can't. I have to go to work. I have to take the kids to school. I have to do the things. And that's an area where we can really support that animal and that pet parent through the use of pharmaceuticals, supplements, nutraceuticals, pheromones to try to reduce that panic response that the animal is going through so that at least temporarily we're helping that animal to be less sensitized, less panicked, less negatively affected by those necessary departures. And when we're able to do those things, either avoiding the departure or minimizing the panic, it then allows us to maximize the efforts that we're putting on the training side to truly change those emotional responses.
And it doesn't have to be drugs or pharmaceuticals. There's, I know, a newer solution that you talk about frequently.
Absolutely. We've got all kinds of things, including the Calmer Canine device, which is an at-home treatment that's relying on electronic magnetic frequencies and all sorts of cool things. So we don't have to use meds. We can. And a lot of these strategies can be used in combination with another, depending on the animal and the severity and the urgency.
So the Calmer Canine device, real quickly, is just that, a device, and you simply put it on the dog through either a halter, it's a wearable device that the dog just wears, and there's no side effect. It affects the brain chemistry in a similar way to pharmaceuticals.
To some degree, yeah. It's operating through a completely different mechanism, but the treatment with that particular device is typically 2 15-minute sessions per day. The pet parent's job is just to keep the animal relatively calm and quiet, hang out for a bit, watch a movie, watch some TV, keep the animal quiet while they're wearing that vest that has that device that is essentially suspended over the kind of the upper shoulders, the back of the head area. And that's it. It's pretty simple to use.
Yeah, and not especially expensive to do either. So this works, in my experience, really, really well.
Yeah, and we've got some really nice data to support that, looking at some of the controlled as well as placebo-controlled trials to see, does this actually work for us? And the answer is yeah, it does.
It truly does. But I want to talk about pharmaceuticals, and I want to talk about some other things that you can do if you have a dog with separation anxiety, and we will do that when we come back on WGN.
This didn't have to happen in a facility in Ohio. So within the listening distance, really, of WGN Radio, Morrow County, Ohio, first responders saved 17 dogs when they were called to a fire in a puppy mill. 70 dogs died. That never should have happened for a whole... First of all, puppy mills, should they be operating in the first place? Of course, you know what my thinking on that is. No, absolutely not. But okay, how did a facility like that ever pass a Department of Agriculture inspection? No matter. This happens way too often where dogs die in a facility because there's no one there to call the fire department. So we need to change that. We did in Illinois several years back. This radio show participated in all that. We have a law in Illinois where there must be smoke alarms, must be, that ring automatically to first responders or a person there 24/7. We need to do this in every state.
Dr. Chris Pockel is a veterinary behaviorist who speaks everywhere, it seems, at every veterinary conference. And one of the topics you talk about frequently is separation anxiety. Do you think that separation anxiety, I asked you earlier, if it's happening more often and if it is the number one issue, and we talked about how it, in fact, might be for dogs. The result of separation anxiety can often mean that that dog is relinquished to a shelter because the human-animal bond fractures. It's terrible for the dog. That dog is suffering, but it's terrible for the people, too, to worry that, okay, the neighbors are going to complain, or to worry that, oh, my house is going to be destroyed. You know, it's awful on both ends, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And that emotional weight that is carried by everybody is really profound.
Yeah, it is. You called, and I've called before, separation anxiety essentially a panic attack. That's what it is. Hard to learn if you're panicked.
Yes.
And behavior modification is at the end. Every veterinary behaviorist I've ever known, no matter what the problem is, it's behavior modification at some point in time.
Yes.
You want to modify that behavior. Usually it can be done. Hard to do, though, if you're panicked.
Hard to do if you're panicked. Yeah, we've got to be able to start at a level of exposure to that scenario, in this case talking about separation or isolation from their people, starting out at a level that the animal can tolerate and actually learn how to be comfortable in that circumstance.
So there's, in my opinion, two kind of heavy hitters to do this. One is a non-pharmaceutical. You mentioned it, the Calmer Canine. But the other is pharmaceuticals. Do you get a lot of pushback from clients that say, I don't want to drug my dog. I don't want to make my dog sleepy. Can you comment on what you hear all the time?
Yeah, absolutely. And I really try to hear those concerns that pet parents have, because generally their concern is my concern. My goal is not to just sedate the animal. My job is not to turn their, you know, loving, playful dog into a lump on the couch. Like that is not the goal. We're not trying to, quote unquote, turn them into a zombie.
But that doesn't happen.
Well, so one of the things that we have to be aware of whenever we're using any sort of pharmaceuticals is that there can be side effects, and they're usually very easy to manage, and sometimes it's a dosing issue, or maybe that's just not the right treatment for that dog. So they are things that could happen, but they're not things that need to happen in order for the drugs or medications to really be effective.
And also, yes, you could adjust the dosage, et cetera. I would argue if it makes the dog just a tad sleepy, not a zombie, but whatever that means, but walking in the middle of the night looking for people, but a tad sleepy while you're gone, better to be a tad sleepy than panicked.
Yeah, the challenge there is really determining, is the animal sleepy and comfortable, or are they panicked and immobile? And those are really important distinctions. So when we're looking at that, just as when we were, you know, thinking about utilizing video to make a diagnosis, we're also using video to confirm that this is an animal who's actually doing normal dog things, or if they're sleeping, they're relaxed, they're comfortable, they've got a normal heart rate, all of these things to really confirm that we are truly addressing the emotional response.
That's a great point, and you can tell just by the way the dog is laying down sometimes.
Yes.
Beside what the dog is sniffing around and doing other doggy things, that in of itself can tell you if the dog is comfortable or not. Can separation anxiety be cured?
I almost never use the word cure.
That's why I ask it that
right?
way.
Right? Yeah, and it's one of those things where, you know, we may be able to, for many of the dogs with appropriate support, we can get to a point where that anxiety, that panic is not being experienced. If there were a traumatic experience, or if we were to pull away some of the supports that we've put into place, that may be an animal that's still a bit more predisposed than your average dog to be more distressed in that environment. So I hesitate to use the word cure as in, cool, it's behind us in the rearview mirror and we never have to think about that ever again. But it absolutely can be successfully treated, and I would argue the majority of cases if we have the resources to do so.
All right, so we've used the pharmaceutical or the Calmer Canine. That dog is now a bit more relaxed anyway when people leave. What kind of behavior modification do you then insert?
It really depends on the dog. And that's, again, where I'm going to come back to video and say, where are you struggling? For some of my patients that I'm working with, it's the departure itself, that sort of pulling away of the Velcro as the person is leaving. And so in those cases, we may do a series of relaxation exercises that gradually introduces that departure routine, or perhaps creates a bit more structure and predictability for that departure routine for the dog. In other cases, we're focusing more on truly creating a positive experience after the owner leaves. And in some cases, we're using remote activated food dispensers, for example. Owner leaves, food rains from the sky. Owner comes back, nothing happens. Owner leaves, food happens. Owner comes back, nothing happens, to create a different experience. So lots of options.
Yeah. And one thing I didn't talk about, that shame on me, I should have, because when we talked about pharmaceuticals, I wanted to talk about this. There aren't many, actually, pharmaceuticals, psychopharmaceuticals, that are specifically for dogs. One of those happens to be for separation anxiety.
Yes.
And I think that even some veterinarians don't talk about this enough or use it enough. And my God, it's for you. You know, it's for dogs. Rather than using a human medication, which can work, yes, for all sorts of scenarios, for all sorts of issues that are used for dogs and cats all the time, this particular product is for dogs.
Yes. So the product you're mentioning there is at least the one that we use that has an FDA label claim for treating canine separation anxiety is Reconcile, which is the trade name canine formulated version of fluoxetine, which a lot of people might recognize as Prozac.
But this is different because it is for dogs, and the dosages for dogs, everything about it is for dogs, and it does seem to make a difference.
It does. We actually see a fair number of patients that come through the practice that have been trialed on the generic version, and maybe there was a partial response, or in some cases not much of a response whatsoever. And when we put them on the formulated version, we see a much more robust response to treatment. So I generally lead out with the FDA approved drug and say, let's give your dog the best possible chance for success.
Which it is.
Absolutely. And then we can see how they respond. And if we're still not getting the response there, cool, then we can try other options. But starting there is absolutely recommended.
Excellent. Well, I think you've solved our problems, at least with separation anxiety. Here's a problem that I want you to try to solve. People go back to work. They have separation anxiety for their dogs. Are you actually seeing that?
So these days, less so with the number of video monitoring devices, but I will say the number of people who actively monitor their pets from the office when the pets are home alone, that I would say has absolutely skyrocketed, and I love it.
I do too. Dr. Chris Pockel, as always, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Ben Seidman is the COO and co-founder of Mella Pet Care. That's a Chicago brand. Yay! From Chicago for a long time, doing things not only for Chicago pets, but for the country. Now, you might know that name because it was just featured on Shark Tank. How does that happen? That's amazing. Congratulations, because not only were you featured on Shark Tank, but it so happens that you were liked by Shark Tank and supported as well. Can you tell me how all of that rolled out, Ben?
Yeah, we're still pinching ourselves, and waking up every day thinking, you know, how did this happen? But you know, Shark Tank came to us, and you know, they scout companies, and it was something that we couldn't pass up. It took, you know, months of preparation, and ultimately we went on stage, we pitched to the sharks, and we got Mark Cuban as an investor. Which, you know, when we went in there, that was kind of, you know, who we were targeting. And it's been really a whirlwind since working with him and his team. But we're really thankful for the opportunity and everything that's come as a result.
Indeed. Now, my thinking is, okay, I'm not about making Mark Cuban richer. However, I am about helping pets. And historically, one of the ways in which we think our pet isn't quite right. Some of us who know what taking a temperature means, you know, what a normal temperature is. Now we can just Google that anyway for dogs and cats. Might do that, but probably not. Actually, you're sticking a thermometer into the rear end of that pet. That pet isn't going to like the experience. I believe that is an understatement. And we don't even know what we're looking for necessarily. And even the veterinarian, so you're not making that veterinary visit a lot of fun for that dog or cat, especially cats, when the veterinarian does that, but the veterinarian needs to know what the temperature is. Now you have, using technology, a way better way to do all that, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, back in the days for humans, when you went into the doctor, they also took your rectal temperature until, you know, humans got fed up with it. And they were like, hey, we need a better way to take our temperature without, you know, dropping down your drawers and taking a rectal temperature. Same thing is for pets and the humanization of pets. You know, pets deserve for their pet parents to be able to take their temperature. And right now, that's just not possible with the tools that we have. But with Mella, we've developed the first and only axillary underarm thermometer that goes under the foreleg or hind leg of a cat or a dog. With millions of data points, we've developed an algorithm to get accurate temperature and to be able to send it to telehealth, to practice management systems, to make that data interoperable so that pet parents can understand that, you know, a 102 is actually a normal temperature for a pet, right? And it starts to learn and engage more with the health of their pet. And that's really our mission as a company.
You know, to me, I think that's a big deal. An even bigger deal has to do with the fact that according to the American Association for Pet Obesity Prevention, 61% of cats are overweight or obese, about 50% of dogs.
That's way too many. We know that this impacts their quality of life, but we also know that it impacts their lifespan. It doesn't need to necessarily be that way. And if we can keep track of our pet's weight, just like we keep track of ours, and if it's easy to do, that can make a huge, pardon the vernacular, difference. And you've come up with a way to do that, Ben.
Yes, the Biggie Body Fat Scale, which is actually named after my own pet, Biggie, who I adopted here in Chicago at Paws Chicago 5 years ago. It's the first ever body fat scale. So we kind of jumped a leap to say, hey, we're not only going to get a pet scale in your home, but it's going to measure the body fat percentage and allow you to understand how your pet measures up against other pets, where your pet should be. If a pet is at a healthy weight, they live on average 2 years longer. 60% of pets are overweight or obese, and it's really an epidemic. That, you know, unfortunately, we love a good chubby pet, right? They bring so much joy to us. But at the end of the day, they need to be at a healthy weight to live happy and healthy lives, and to live, you know, really as pain-free as possible. So we believe that that's coming more and more to our pets as a, you know, kind of the fitness and diet and health, momentum has been for humans. We're trying to provide those tools that, you know, give pet parents the data and help them to be able to be better pet parents.
And taking your cat to the veterinarian to be weighed is not something people do often because, unfortunately, cats don't visit the veterinarian as often as we'd like them to. And even with a small dog or a cat in particular, you getting on a scale and then doing the subtraction, trying to figure that all out, is not a very accurate way to do it, first. And secondly, you have no idea about the body condition score of that pet. And your system, it is for dogs and cats, right?
Exactly. It's for dogs and cats to be able to not only get the weight, but also the body fat percentage through our impedance pad. And we also have something called the tabby tape measure, which gets the morphometrics of the pet. Because unlike humans, where we can, you know, grab onto that metal rod and it'll tell us our body fat percentage. Pets are all different shapes and sizes, and breed matters more. So a poodle is going to have different dimensions than a greyhound. So all of that is important, and we're building those algorithms for the first time. So being able to understand how much your pet diet is changing, as well as how much the weight is changing as well. For cats, weight decline can mean a number of different things in terms of, you know, renal or kidney disease. So there's so many different applications of just having that weight data in the home and being able to ultimately share it with your veterinarian.
That's brilliant. I love it. I do need your website, though, so people can learn more.
Absolutely. That's www.mella, it's MELLA.AI. We're also available on Amazon and Chewy. And thank you, Steve. Definitely come check us out.
I indeed will. And I thank you very much for your time. And congratulations again, Shark Tank success. Thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Steve. Appreciate the opportunity.
So what do you think the most common behavior complaint in dogs is today? It's separation anxiety. It was on the rise anyway, but now that the pandemic hit, it went way up. And one can guess as to why that is, but there's no guessing about the fact that many of these dogs, the human-animal bond fractures, or HOAs, or the landlord says you must give up that dog if you don't fix, quote-unquote, that dog by tomorrow. So dogs land in shelters with separation anxiety and then may be euthanized as a result of that. So what can we do to prevent going down that road in the first place? Well, can there be a prevention for separation anxiety? That's something I need to talk about down the road. But once your dog is diagnosed with it, it's a panic attack, and you cannot learn. There's behavior modification and other things that can and will help, but you cannot learn if you are panicked. So there are one of two ways to essentially stop that panic. One, psychopharmaceuticals. The good news is they work. And the additional good news is on two ends. One can be immediate. I'm leaving the house in an hour. I know that. What do I give my dog? And there is something to give your dog. And for more long term. So that's a very good thing. But a lot of people cannot drug their dog, or they don't want to give their dog drugs, whatever the case may be. There is something else called the Calmer Canine. This product you simply hold over the dog's head. You can do it at home. It emits pulsed electromagnetic therapy, and it works essentially doing the same thing as the psychopharmaceuticals do. It's less expensive long-term than using drugs. Now, it doesn't kick in overnight. It may take 2 weeks to 6 weeks to actually do what you need it to do so the dog is no longer panicked. But the fact is, it really does work. Again, it's called the Calmer Canine. We will talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.